By the time my father had died, the war between the North and the South, which had been so long threatened, had broken out, and the gunplay was on. Quite all of the able-bodied men capable of bearing arms throughout the country were enthusiastically enlisting in some of the many military organizations that were being formed, and going from their homes into military encampments. Although completely captivated by the glowing reports of the excitement, I ignored my boyish inclinations and declined to join the army. I could not see how mother and the children could possibly support themselves without my assistance, who was the oldest of the flock, and now quite useful as a bread earner. I therefore held back quite a while longer. But in some quarters it was said, here is Walsh Grayson, who is a well-educated young man, capable of making a useful soldier in the army as a commissioned officer or otherwise, and yet he declines to join the army. He should be made to take his place in one of the companies and do duty as others are doing. This kind of talk, besides occasional innuendos derogatory to my personal courage in case of a conflict of arms, determined me to enter the field and show my critics, if occasion offered, the stuff I was made of, even if it cost me my life to make the exhibition. How long I served as a private soldier, I do not know. But the need of my services, especially in view of my supposed superior education and fitness and ability in the conduct of the affairs of our company, was pressing. Having in years not attained my majority, I was a mere boy, and by far the youngest captain serving in the Indian Brigade. The first time that I with my company came anywhere near taking part in a scrap with the enemy, as I now recall, was at the Battle of Honey Springs, some 2 or 3 miles north of the present town of Jakota. We'd been encamped in the vicinity of the springs for some weeks when the enemy, under General Blunt, came out of Fort Gibson to see what we were doing and incidentally to feel our pulse, if advisable. With my own men and a pickled body of others from the 2nd Creek Regiment, without Colonel Chili McIntosh in immediate command, we were ordered to occupy a certain position in the dense bottom of the creek. Here we remained, listening breathlessly at the rattle of small arms and an occasional exulting whoop that was one of the characteristics of the fighters of the Southern forces, and anxious to take a hand in the affray, but could do nothing without orders. By what I have always confidently believed to be bad management, we lost the day here when the enemy came up and engaged us, for our General Cooper did not even get all his men out on the firing line, or into any engagement with his adversary before he ordered his forces to retire. Although on this occasion I remember hearing delivered by our colonel in Indian the finest war speech I ever heard. When you first saw the light, it was said of you, a man-child is born. You must prove today whether or not this saying of you was true. The sun that hangs over our heads has no death, no end of days. It will continue indefinitely to rise and to set, but with you, it is different. Man must die sometime, and since he must die, he can find no nobler death than that which overtakes him while fighting for his home, his fires, and his country. The retreat left the families resident in the country without any protection, and as the enemy was destroying everything in the way of their march, it was important that each family and non-combatant decide, and quickly, whether to remain at home and trust the mercy of the invading enemy, or load up such few things as they were compelled to have into wagons, and as our forces were doing, follow in retreat towards the Choctaw Nation. In general, our soldiers were poorly clad, and most of the time my company presented a motley appearance. The Confederacy, being hard run, had very little in the way of clothing to issue to the men on the part of the country, and we were never very presentable. So when we called a prisoner from the other side, we generally stripped him clean of his wearing apparel as we desired, they being always better than our own, and placed upon him instead such as our own old duds as he could wear. Our government had issued our men certain wool hats, which appeared to be manufactured of the plain sheep's wool without any colouring, while the hatter seemed not to have seriously concerned himself about the symmetry and poise of any individual hat. One such hat, that had well nigh served its time and collected its full share of dust and discolorations, was owned and worn by McAnally. Being a young man of decidedly Indian taste in matters of dress and orientation, he embellished it in true Aboriginal style, with one of the plumes of the wing of the falcon, commonly known in the country as the chicken hawk, the shaft of which had been carefully pared away and rendered so thin, pliant and limber that the least air disturbance gave it a vibratory, or rather tremulous motion, highly responsive to the Indian's idea of aesthetics. This feather he had securely fastened in the apex of his hat, where it had for considerable time done service, doubtless to the admiration of his comrades in war. As we were riding along discussing the situation, we reached a small Choctaw farm of probably not over 10 acres in extent on our right, planted in corn. As we rode silently along, I observed ahead of us horses, which appeared to be tied to the fence. We saw at first no riders, although the horses were saddled and bridled. We halted and listened for the sound of voices, but heard none. We then stealthily crept nearer, where we saw, I think, two men lying near up to the fence, fast asleep. My blonde friend seemed to think that this was our time to get in our work on the enemy, and suggested that we rush upon them and dispatch them while they slept. He had already impressed me as being not very practical in some of his ideas and views, and fearing he might be dependent on the certain operation of his little old pistol, which might fail to work when we reached the dispatching moment and cause us to be killed or taken prisoners, I asked to examine the gun. At a glance, I became satisfied that there was great danger it would not fire at all, and a wise view of the situation manifestly dictated that we go slow in the proposed work of death. But we had no clubs at hand with which we might club them to death, and I was not sure that my blonde friend and I were able to pounce upon these men and choke them to death. I counseled that we leave them to the continued enjoyment of their slumbers while we turned out into the woods, continuing our course, but not travelling the roads. Sometime after this, a raid was planned to cross the enemy's line and attack a party of haymakers who were encamped on the prairie north of the Verdigris River, under protection of a detachment of soldiers from Fort Gibson. It seemed to be the policy of the military authorities to use our Indian Brigade not so much for service outside of the Indian Territory as a menace to the enemy's southern line. We were constantly watching for weak places or insufficiently protected interests where we might run in, deliver a damaging blow, and fly quickly to the cover of our base, which in the later years of the war was in the Choctaw Nation. It was a kind of warfare that was suited to the Indian character, and in carrying out the policy we continually attracted the notice of the enemy to ourselves, thus keeping him from concentrating with others of his forces and aiding in giving effective battle to some of our larger armies, which had already all the enemy that they would care to deal with. But now it appeared that the Choctaws, none of whom that were with us in this raid, had the reputation with the enemy of being heartless and of never sparing the life of any enemy that came into their power. This was untrue, but nevertheless confidently believed by the enemy. When some of our soldiers made the hideous yells and charged the enemy's left, they were mistaken for the deadly Choctaw, for, as the enemy thought, who but he could utter such blood-curdling noises? They reasoned that to yield their position and trust to flight for safety would mean their certain capture and massacre on the prairies adjoining their camps by these notorious and bloodthirsty Choctaws, the only alternative being that of remaining where they were and fight it out. The latter alternative they adopted, and those who were giving way to flight returned, and put up such a stiff resistance that we were after a while forced to reconsider our plans and give up the fight. In this case, the entire number of men volunteering to engage in the raid did not, I think, exceed 300. Major Howland of one of the Cherokee regiments was placed in command, and in this number of raiders, there were Cherokee and Creeks from both of the Creek regiments. I was of the number with a few men from my immediate company. I remember that my cousin, Valentine N. McAnally, elsewhere mentioned as being a month older than myself, who was a member of my company, was with me on this occasion. The raid so far was regarded by the men as eminently successful, although at the cost of one life and a painful wound. The men had captured and appropriated many of the various articles of value from the camps of the enemy when they charged them. Now, as they were on their return, they crossed the river, and being tired and anxious to examine and see more closely the booty they had each taken, they halted on the south banks of the river where the bluffs were high and steep. The boys were much pleased, many of them, with their hauls, and were busily engaged in showing each other their goods and trading, swapping, and buying them from one another in high glee. Going up out of the bluffs to the top, I dismounted, and with my bridle reins in my hands, followed my horse around while he was picking the grass, which was very good here, and awaited orders to march. Before such order was given, however, and while the trade was brisk upon and below the bluffs, the enemy, whom we had ransacked and dispersed, having rallied, got together in considerable force, crept up through the bottoms on the opposite side, and dealt us a volley from the thick brush, the stream only being about 50 yards wide here, which created a panic in our trade and dire consternation among the traders. Men who had dropped their bridle reins, giving their horses full liberty to graze on the grass at will, were now running to and fro, calling to others to catch their horses for them. The horses, when approached by frightened men, would in turn become frightened at the unusual actions of their masters and scamper away, which, but for its seriousness, would have been in the highest degree laughable. We then discovered that our commanding officer, Major Howland, was not with us. There were those who declared that the officer was wounded by the enemy's first volley. Captain Sam Gunter of the Cherokees would probably be next in command, and indeed was already rallying the men and apparently waiting to get them into some sort of shape for resistance or attack of the enemy. What to do was the question that was uppermost to us. We held a council of war, as it may be called, on horseback, when Captain Gunter declared that if we could get a sufficient number of men to follow him, he would attack the enemy. Our men, however, exhibited no mind for engaging in his proposed enterprise. I told the captain, for one, I would follow him. Bean Burgess said that he would also go, and while there may have been others who proffered their services, I do not recall any. While we were talking, Captain Gunter decided that he would not make the venture, as he said he himself was wounded and in no proper condition for leading a fight. The captain, however, could hardly have been called wounded, as what he designated as a wound, as I now recall, was only this. One of the enemy's bullets had struck the large brass army buckle or clasp that fastened his leather belt in front, and without going through it, had reddened and bruised his skin, and probably jarred him considerably at the moment of impact. This was all. With this decision, we, as I must say, ignominiously left the field and our commander without any effort toward determining his fate or rendering him any assistance. A detachment was sent out in 2 days afterwards who found him making his way back to camps over the route, travelling by his command, and brought him safely to camp. A short time after this, I think it was, a new commander came into our wing of the theatre of war and did some very creditable work. This was a General Richard M. Gano, who before long in this department received information of a valuable train of wagons belonging to the enemy and all loaded with supplies for the post of Fort Gibson, which was moving down from Fort Scott, Kansas. He determined to go after and meet these people and, if possible, take them in. After several days of preparation, some 2,000 men, as I believe, consisting of Creeks, Seminoles, Cherokees, and Texans, with a battery of 4 pieces of artillery, were gotten in readiness for the expedition. I joined this expedition, it having become my rule and purpose to take part in all proposed raids against the enemy. It is perhaps right to explain here that such inclinations did not necessarily signify bravery, courage, or desire in me for recklessly courting and facing danger, as I found some of my associates interpreted it, but rather the dominating influence of the somewhat commonplace thirst for excitement and desire for action, characteristic, more or less, of all young people. From here, we now moved on after bigger game. In 2 days thereafter, as I now recall, we reached the encampment of the enemy early in the morning, the fires of which we could clearly see for quite a considerable distance before we were sufficiently near to offer them battle. Arriving, however, in easy reach and it being yet dark, we formed in order of battle and stood, awaiting the light of day, when we could see how to meet and dispute the men of which we had come so far to see. While we were quietly awaiting the light, it appeared quite clear from the boisterous and careless talk of the enemy, which we could plainly hear, that there had been some drinking, and that at least some of the men were now under the influence of drink. Some of them called at us, "What are you doing here? What do you want?" Some of our men answered, We are after you and your mule teams and wagons. Presently, one of the enemy, who evidently was drunk, after heaping upon us all manner of vile epithets and curses, started over our way, never ceasing his curses as he came. He came, as I recall, in such a way as to reach the south end of our line as we stood, and presently one of the men called to him, "Halt!" He appeared to pay no heed to the challenge, but continued his advance when we heard again the call to halt. This did not check his movements, so the third and last challenge was made, and within a few moments, a shot, then another, and all was quiet. It was now light enough for us to see what we should do, and the order coming to us to fire, our men obeyed with alacrity and spirit, and things certainly now began to appear decidedly warlike. Before resuming, and while waiting in line for further orders, some members of my company, having great faith in certain Indian war medicine, said to afford protection against the casualties of battle, produced the medicine, talisman or whatever the article was, I never saw it, and distributed it to those who desired its protection, which they proceeded to use by rubbing it on and about the clothing of the body and limbs as thoroughly as they could within the limited time they had for taking the treatment. My first lieutenant, Supofe Fixico, Thomas Benton as he was called in English, I distinctly recall, offered to supply me with a treatment, saying, "Aren't you going to use this?" I declined his proffered kindness, it still being in me to prove to these men that I was willing to risk myself in the presence of danger under the impulses of my innate courage, without resorting to the supposed protection afforded by medicines or talismans, and prove to them that I could meet the risks as coolly as the bravest soldier under me, and was not the man to shirk danger, as some at one time seemed to think I was. I had loudly encouraged and cheered my men from the first, speaking always in Indian, until my voice gave way under the continued strain, and was now only a whisper, and could scarcely be heard at all. Pleasant Porter always told me afterwards that, being with the charge when the stockades were taken, he looked about him and saw not a single Creek besides himself when there had been so many on the firing line in the battle proper. He was just experiencing a feeling of regret that the Creeks did not have greater representation in this crowning act of actual victory, when looking over a few steps from where he stood, he saw me, the only other Creek, and felt an experience of relief. It was a sort of feeling as if the honour of the Creeks in this engagement in which we were victorious had been sufficiently vindicated. One evening, when the men had been some hours reeling off to each other yarns funny and otherwise, and conversation was lagging, I recall distinctly how Jackson Munaway rose from where he'd been sitting. Starting to go to the fire to light his pipe, he remarked, "When under our former captain, we made loud complaints of his lack of courage to lead us to battle. We charged he was cowardly. I'm sure we have nothing to complain of now." The former captain was an old man and really not a man for action, and least of all military action, but he was put in the office because he was old and was regarded as one of the wise men of the Eufaula town of Indians. Much had been said in complaint against his inactivity, and this remark was meant for a compliment to me, and was so understood by all. I never for a moment expected such a compliment, as Indians rarely ever say things complimentary to a person in his presence. This was therefore all the more gratifying to me, as proving that I had fully succeeded in satisfying my friends and my enemies if I had any, that I could, and would, willingly go as far toward meeting a dangerous proposition as any other of my age and experience. I, however, have sometimes doubted whether I was entitled to any credit for what others regarded as courage in me, for the reasons that at the time I was but a boy and probably did not fully appreciate the dangers around me. I don't think I did. The brave and courageous man, in my present more mature judgment, is he who in his normal mental condition clearly sees, as he believes, imminent danger and even probable death before him, and yet, without shrinking, coldly faces and goes into it, because, as he believes, it is his duty to do so.